The halfway point in our Word and Life Fall series. Our fifth session today is centered on Chapter 7, Support and Wholeness, and Chapter 8, Self-Giving. I have the privilege of introducing a man who truly needs no introduction, Tim Burnett, who you all know as our Zoom guru. I hope you read his bio on the Word and Life website or on the email invite that Judith sent out for this meeting. And also check out all of our speakers for the series and also in the past. I won't repeat what you can read yourself, but I would want to add a personal note about Tim and say a bit more about his work with the Wave Collective, which he just briefly mentioned in his bio. I met Tim several years ago before he became involved with Word and Life when he led an annual men's retreat for Trinity Episcopal Church. The retreat was focused on the writings of Rob Bell, which Tim wove into his own theological thinking and life experiences to encourage and support us in examining our own spiritual development. Tim was then, and still is now, challenging us with some important questions, including, who are you becoming and what are you growing into? Tim founded the Way Collective at a brewery of all places, so people could explore these questions in the Jesus Way tradition. The Way Collective meets for dinner and dialogue on Wednesday evenings and sponsors Sophia reading groups, which I personally have greatly appreciated and challenged my thinking and expanded my thinking. Tim also brings excited speakers to our community, including people like Rob Bell, Brian McLaren, and Diana Butler Fast. I encourage you to learn more about the work of him and his colleagues at the Way Collective by visiting their website, thewaycollective.org. And with that, I'll turn our session over to Tim.
Wonderful. Thanks, Michael. Well, it's good to be with you all today. As Michael mentioned, I'm here with you every week, but not always as a contributor in this fashion. So it's wonderful to get to spend time with you each week, but also to contribute something to this larger conversation we've been having around this call to uncommon courage. So the intention of this fall series has really been to come into touch with the prophetic in each of us on some level in order to encourage us to stand up to and speak out against the forces of evil in our troubled world. Namely, those of us who are part of this contemplative community here at Word and Life are curious about how this prophetic dimension of our lives can be also a practicing of a new kind of consciousness that Jesus taught to help reconnect our fragmented culture. We've been doing this each week by speakers sharing wonderful reflections on the reading, but also by uplifting people, those prophetic voices that they have found to be meaningful contributions to the stream of prophetic traditions across the centuries. And so today, I want to reflect on this idea of a new kind of consciousness that embodies the prophetic from the angle of Joan Chittister's encouragements from chapters 7 and 8, and also putting them into conversation with the observations of the 20th century mystic and liberation theologian, Dorothy Zola. So my hope this morning is to take Zola's invitation seriously to erase the distinction between the mystical internal and a political external, and to distill out what this means for a contemplative spirituality that moves for justice in the world, not as an afterthought to the contemplative life, but precisely as its outworking in the world. So I'm not sure how familiar some of you are with Dorothy Zola's work, but I wanted to just first offer a little brief biography of her in case some of you aren't as acquainted. And so she was born in 1929 in Cologne, Germany, and her father was a professor of labor law who would later become the first president of the West German Federal Labor Court in the 50s and 60s. And Zola studied theology, philosophy, and literature at the University of Cologne, earning a doctorate with a thesis on the connections between theology and poetry. So for those of you who are attuned to the Theopoetics conversation, I used to host the Theopoetics podcast. Sounds like she would have been a kindred spirit. to us. So she became active in politics, speaking out against the Vietnam War and the arms race of the Cold War and injustices in the developing world. And between 1975 and 1987, she spent 6 months a year at Union Theological Seminary in New York City, where she was a professor of systematic theology. She wrote nearly 20 books on everything from theology to feminist identity to mysticism and liberationist ethics. And one of her most recent observations for today that is resonant today comes from her book, Beyond Mere Obedience, Reflections on a Christian Ethic for the Future, where she coined the term Christofascism. And she made up this term to describe what she saw happening in fundamentalist movements in the United States. And so she describes this term Christofascism as what she calls a soft fascism, or sort of a passive fascism, whose characteristics of chauvinism, nationalism, international militarization, racism, violence, and anti-communist sentiment were not enforced, but rather freely bought by the public. Again, she was writing this in a pre-January 6th riot world, you know, in the 20th century, and it shows some of her prophetic insight now that we see a lot of Christofascism sort of here on our home soil taking root. So toward the end of her life, her last book, The Silent Cry, Mysticism and Resistance, serves as a sort of magnum opus, really her last word on drawing together these themes of contemplation and action and how they play themselves out in the world. So if you haven't read any of her work, you know, The Silent Cry is a wonderful place to begin. And so in it, she writes this: I seek to erase the distinction between a mystical internal and a political external. Everything that is within needs to be externalized so it doesn't spoil. There is no experience of God that can be so privatized that it becomes and remains the property of one owner, the privilege of a person of leisure, the esoteric domain of the initiated. To erase the distinction between the mystical internal and a political external. This, I believe, was part of the goal of her life's work. So notice that she draws a connection here between the privatization of spirituality and the need to have a spirituality that works itself out in the world. She's writing on this theme really in order to combat two things that I still see rampant today in our Western spiritual landscape: exceptionalism and individualism, which are both tools of neoliberal ideals that contribute more to our fragmentation than they do to our enlightenment, these ideas of exceptionalism and individualism. You see, as we work this idea out, that there's a tendency in Western spirituality toward privatizing the experience of God, we can easily create barriers not only between one another on our spiritual pilgrimages, but also barriers toward walking this path of the kind of consciousness that Jesus invites us into. Because if we become so focused on interiority, we cannot, as Sister Chittister writes in her Call to Uncommon Courage, focus on a necessary form of self-giving, giving ourselves back to the world. Now, let me be clear that, of course, there's an interior wild that is yours alone to navigate in your inner experience, you know, and that is an adventure in coming home to yourself. But what Zola was observing was that when spirituality stops there at that point of navel gazing, you know, it only goes halfway. And so she wanted to see this natural overflow of what is happening inward be taken out into the world. So listen to what she says here in this quote. Zola's contention is that we need both interiority and exteriority, right? So she says, we need both the inner light of being one with every living thing and the resistance against the machine of death, is what she says. Both mysticism and resistance must be co-mingled together in what she sees as a critical non-duality that has at its very heart a sort of communal dimension to it, an outworking of it. And listen to how close that claim is to what Sister Chittister says in chapter 7 from our book today. In it, she quotes the liberation theologian Gustavo Gutierrez in saying, "Mystical language expresses the gratuitousness of God's love, while prophetic language expresses the demands that this love makes." Mm. It is one thing to see the spiritual life as the mystical path to God, and it's dishonest to deny even to ourselves the demands of its prophetic dimension. One without the other is simply impossible. You're starting to see that kind of resonance there. You know, Cornel West, who's another brilliant thinker that's contemporary in our time, says that justice is what love looks like in public, right? Okay, so I think that we're getting a picture of this encouragement here. Both experience of the inner light, and as Jesus says, becoming the light of the world, which when applied in our world, resists the death-dealing tendencies of our systems. Both the mystical internal and an externalized political dimension together. Both language that expresses gratuitous love and language that expresses the demands this love makes in the world. Sister Chittister says in chapter 8 here that the questions for spiritual people today are simple. What message do people get from us? What sky do we light up so that others may find their way to new peace and clear justice in a violently unjust world? So there's this moment of pause here, right? As we reflect upon our own spiritual lineages and our spiritual journeys, what have we inherited and what are we embodying now? So as you think about your own spirituality and practice, is there one dimension that outweighs the other for you? Are you most focused on the inner experience? Are you most focused on the inner experience and less on the outworking of prophetic resistance? Or some of us can become so focused on the political that the externalized dimension of justice in the world that we have no grounding practices to sustain us in that work. That has become one very real aspect of activist culture today, that we cannot resist for the duration of time prophetic action is demanded and needed if we don't tend to our inner lives. Okay, and so in any respect, wherever you feel like you might fall on that spectrum of the interior and exterior dimensions, the goal is not only to erase the distinction between them, but to bring them into a vital harmony that can sustain prophetic work in the world. So for a moment, I want to offer you a practical example of what that looks like in case you're having a hard time catching the vision of how this can get itself done. So primarily, Zola's understanding is that this outworking of our spirituality happens most fluidly when we can have solidarity with the oppressed or the impoverished. She calls this having a mysticism of wide open eyes, you know, like not looking away from anything, which is a mystical perspective having awakened to death and suffering in the world. And I know that us Wordenlifers know that people are hurting and that people die. But what she's really hitting at here is having an awareness of those who are undergoing suffering and death unjustly. So drawing on the work of the Brazilian poet João Cabral, in the wake of his poem, The Death and Life of Severino. Severino is a Brazilian word that means the nameless one. She observes that in the wake of those who die namelessly due to unjust causes, a mysticism of wide open eyes is one that, in the midst of death, wants nothing else but to love life, even where analysis has run its course and all that is left is to count the victims. So she encourages us to love life, also, even especially where it has been long condemned to death, even from its very beginning. And that this is an old human ability to go beyond what is. The ability is called transcendence or faith or hope. So prophets are people of hope precisely because they are able to call forth life in the midst of death. And I would guess that each of you are attuned to some issue of justice in the world, from what is happening with Ukraine and Russia, maybe for example, to climate devastation, for example, to racial injustice and racialized violence in our own country, to even maybe more locally, the housing crisis in our own backyard. The point is, a mysticism of wide open eyes is not in denial of what is happening in our world, but seeks to meet a hurting world with a loving and compassionate presence. Sister Chittister says it this way in chapter 8. The prophetic act is always done for the good of others, to save lives in unjust wars. The prophet is loud, clear, and nonviolent. And there is nothing self-serving in the actions of the prophet. And on the contrary, prophets almost always suffer loss of social status and an increase of personal rejection. And elsewhere, she notes that what prophetic spirituality most demands of us is the strength to go against the very crowds that have formed us. So perhaps one way to erase the distinction between the mystical internal and the political external is to find that place where an injustice in the world presses in on you, and to seek to meet that place with a compassionate touch. I love that author Rachel Naomi Remen says that rather than being overwhelmed by the systemic unjust forces at play in our world, there is a simple, quiet call. And it's not about healing the world by making a huge difference. It's about healing the world that touches you, that's around you. And this is a practical call that any of us can heed, right? To be a healing presence to those parts of the world that touch your life and my life. Sometimes when we see the enormity of what is happening in the world, we can become overwhelmed to the point of paralysis, a feeling like what we're facing is too big for us to handle. And on some level, that intuition is correct. You or I are not going to stop climate devastation alone. That's a fact. But what we can do, and indeed I would say this is a prophetic act, is plant a tree. What we can do is work on our consumption levels. What we can do is seek to find ways of traveling with less emissions. It's a drop in the bucket. But you know what? As the Talmud states, do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. Do justly now. Love mercy now. Walk humbly now. You are not obligated to complete the work, but neither are you free to abandon it. Isn't that beautiful? So let me give you a for instance in my own journey of this sort of solidarity with the suffering ones thing, of a mysticism of wide open eyes. When I was 27 or 28 years old, I was a minister at a PCUSA church down in Orange County, and I was in seminary at the time, and some of you know this part of my journey, but during that time, I also got diagnosed with cancer. So I was in this time of learning and integrating new ideas, but then I had this existential emergency where I had a brush with my own mortality and my finitude and the possibility of death. What happened on the other side of this experience was that I had this newfound space within me that was carved out by my own experience of suffering. Now, I was brought up in a pretty fundamentalist Christian home. Most of the spiritual communities and spaces I'd been a part of had been evangelical in nature, but this suffering did something to me that sort of pushed me out of those modes of being. And what struck me as so profound was how almost overnight, my social values shifted after this very personalized experience of my own suffering. I sort of started to have eyes to see who else around me was hurting. Have you ever had an experience like that where you go through something and all of a sudden you have this newfound connection with other people who have gone through something, even though it may not have been the same thing, but there's a sort of a compassion there? And one of the first issues that came to my attention was the way that churches like mine were treating folks in the LGBTQIA+ community. Toward the end of my time at this church, the church was actually trying to leave the PCUSA over this topic, along with a few other weird theological things. And so I started to have some conversations with the senior leadership at my church about this. And my discomfort with taking such a harsh stance against folks who I didn't see were any less beloved than myself. And at a certain point in those conversations, one of the senior leaders turned and said to me, "Well, Tim, I think God is calling you elsewhere." And so at the time I was like, well, I didn't get a call. I've had my cell phone with me, right? God didn't give me that call. But now they ended up putting a stop date to my employment and essentially letting me go over my convictions there. But now looking back, I realized that he was probably right. I no longer fit in with the values of the in-group of that community. Now, I'm by no means a prophet or anything like that, but I did resonate with Sister Chittister's words that prophetic spirituality most demands, or what it most demands of us, is the strength to go against the very crowds that formed us, right? And so for me, it wasn't that intentional to try to be going against. It was just like a natural evolution of the space that was being made in me. And so when we move in our own spiritual journeys toward a mysticism of wide open eyes, with a commitment to solidarity with the suffering ones, it will sometimes call us to speak up for and say things that, for the sake of that love being worked out in the world, get us into what John Lewis calls good trouble, right? But here's how Zola says it so beautifully, profoundly, and succinctly. I love this. I hope y'all, if you catch anything this morning, catch this. She says, what mystics call becoming at one is never a possession that cannot be lost. What really happens in mystical union is not a new vision of God, but a different relationship to the world, one that has borrowed the eyes of God. Some of you might have heard that quote before. In fact, I might have shared it at Word and Life because I tend to say it quite often. But you see, in the West, many of us think that a new understanding of God is moving toward a more correct concept of God. And while ideas matter, I wonder if Zola's insight here is more what it's about. This new consciousness that Jesus invites of us is one that moves first from a place of union, union with God, but also union with the world. And her brilliant insight here is that the inner shift that takes place within us is that union creates a different relationship with the world around us. It creates a relationship that doesn't see God differently, but sees with the very eyes of God, who is always looking out for those who are being oppressed and impoverished. Sounds like a pretty nice idea, right? But you have to realize the boldness of a claim like this, that in claiming this, she was considered by many to be a heretic for. Zilla's prophetic critique is against the assumption that God is all-powerful and the cause of our suffering, and that humans thus suffer for some greater purpose. And instead, she posits that God suffers and is powerless alongside us. That's a radical claim. And that the outworking of this seeing through the eyes of God is that humans are to struggle together against oppression, sexism, anti-Semitism, forms of authoritarianism, and the like. And that this is really the prophetic dimension of our spiritualities. And so I'll leave you with this final quote from Dorothy Zilla, which sort of sums up her claim that resistance is the outworking of mysticism. And she says this: mysticism is the experience of the oneness and the wholeness of life. Therefore, mysticism's perception of life, its vision, is also the unrelenting perception of how fragmented life is. Suffering on account of that fragmentation and finding it unbearable is part of that mysticism. Finding God fragmented into rich and poor, top and bottom, sick and well, weak and mighty, that's the mystic suffering. The resistance of St. Francis or Elizabeth of Thuringia or of Martin Luther King's grew out of the perception of beauty. There was a fundamental beauty about the world. And the long-lasting and most dangerous resistance is the one that is born from that beauty. So as mystics, we have this fundamental conviction that the world is beautiful, and that even especially in that place in your own soul, there's a point of homecoming of your inherent beauty, your inherent dignity, your inherent worth. And we move from that place to resist anything in the world that is ugly. So finally, I love that Sister Chittister reminds us in these chapters, like Zilla's encouragement at the outset today, to get over the individualism, exceptionalism, and privatization of Western spirituality, to seek contemplative friendships. She has this emphasis on friendship in this chapter. She places a strong value on finding people with whom you can not only talk about such things as these, like we do at Word and Life, but also walk in prophetic resistance together with them. And I feel that Word and Life is such a community as this, that uplifts both the internal and external dimensions of a prophetic spirituality and offers us a contemplative connections with one another to sustain this beautiful prophetic work. Sulla actually thinks of God as what she calls a silent cry. She says that the silent cry is a mystical name for God, whose divine power is not grounded in domination and commandment, but it's a name that everyone can use. Everyone who misses the silent cries that have become inaudible among us of the victims of the world. And so she says, may the one who cries in us help us all to learn to hear the cry in the foundations of the world. And she encourages us that a life that is open to everyone, which is a Quaker image, really, this life of boundless happiness, of absolute fearlessness, is also one of constant difficulty. The prophetic life is one of constant struggle. And there are human beings who not only hear the silent cry, which is God, but also make it heard as the music of the world that even to this day fulfills the cosmos and the soul. And so this is the mystical life. This is the contemplative life where Christ is the very place in you where the suffering of the world is. And so, yeah, I love this picture that Dorothy Zola offers up for us. And I think as we kind of talk this morning about, in the midst of our contemplative friendships, this idea of erasing the distinction between the mystical internal and the political external, my hope is that we can come into touch with this outworking of our spirituality together. Okay, so I want to share with you just a quick resource for those of you who are trying to, again, make this practical. This comes from a professor of mine out at Claremont School of Theology. Named Frank Rogers. And if you're not familiar with his work, I would point you to it because it is he just makes a beautiful contribution to the contemplative landscape. And so, but this is called The Wheel of Compassion-Based Activism. And I'm going to just share it with you right now. Can you all see that? Can you give me a thumbs up if you can see that? Is that coming through your screen? Okay, I'm going to make it as full screen as I can. So, for those of us who are longing to move from this place of oneness and groundedness with a level of prophetic compassion and action in the world, I found this to be just a really helpful way to not continue to contribute to the fragmentation, but to welcome difficult others into this mystical resistance. So if you notice here, there's a wheel, and the colors on the wheel kind of connect to one another. And essentially, there's a sort of a polar kind of side to this, where there's a connection between things like the top there, having firm limits around violation. You know, one of the things Frank says is that violence is an affront to the moral fabric of our society. So we cannot compromise this resistance to violence. So we have firm limits around it. But we also carry with that a sort of universal inclusivity, that even the oppressors cannot be composted in the process, but instead must be somehow seen within a larger circle that connects with us. So again, firm limits around violation, universal inclusivity. The next one, if we go to a strategic focus on systemic violence, has to connect with imaginative social problem solving. So essentially here, again, we're focusing on removing violence from our society. So there's a nonviolent bent in this theory that connects with Sister Chittister's, connects with Dorothy Zola's, but that has to be met with sort of imaginative social problem solving, because we can't just resist it. We have to structuralize it on some level. Okay, this other idea here, the teal one, having love for an adversary, having love for a difficult other, having love for that person who you could not be more opposite across the aisle from, you know, carries with it a sense of empowered personal dignity, again, in you, seeing the beauty in you and in others. So we uphold dignity to everyone, you know, no matter who they are. And lastly, part of this engaging in compassionate activism is being open to another's truth in this orange line here, which is merged with having a grounded, non-reactive presence in the world. A lot of our activist endeavors are reactive. And in that reactivity, we actually only end up bouncing back the same level of division and fragmentation that we are receiving and trying to resist. And so how do we stay grounded? How do we, you know, have these firm limits around violation? How do we strategically focus on systemic violence and try to eradicate it from this place of empowered personal dignity, universal inclusivity, love for one's adversary? I'll just say I've found this to be just a beautiful and helpful wheel, so that I don't get lost in the throes of today's prophetic resistance. So I hope that that's helpful for you. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it later in our conversation. But for now, I want to offer up some time for us to just kind of sit with this. And so, yeah, before we go to our reflection groups, is there anything that's jumping out at you that you'd like clarification on at this point?
Tim, I wonder if you could spell Dorothy's name for the folks.
That's really helpful. Thanks, Judith. I can. It's Dorothee, and her last name is spelled Solle. And the O has the little over it. So yeah, Dorothy Zolle. It's Solee. Sometimes you see it, I think, misspelled, but Solle.
I'm sorry, this is my first session. Could you tell me a little bit more of what you mean by the warden? And I can't remember what comes after that philosophy, or could you tell me more about what you meant by that?
What was the phrase? I missed it, I think.
I don't know. I thought you said something, maybe I have the wrong term, about the warden way of thinking, or the maybe I just missed it, and I'll wait to hear it again.
Sorry. It might have said Western. I don't know. Okay. I didn't say warden, but.
Okay, yeah. Sorry.
Well, I've got a few questions for us I want to throw in the chat before we move to reflection groups. Again, if there's anything else, I'm looking forward to the conversation later. I will admit here, I'm feeling pretty faint just because I'm battling this little cold. So I'm hoping to last through the end of our session. But these are going to be what we will talk about together today for about 20 minutes or so. Remember that image of Rachel Naomi Remen saying, you know, heal the world that touches you. So what injustice in the world touches your life? And what does it look like for you to be a healing presence in the world? How is that kind of taking root in your own spirituality? Second question. Similarly to the question, these are questions directly from Sister Joan Chittister. What message do people get from us? What sky do we light up so that others may find their way to new peace and clear justice in a violently unjust world? Good question. And lastly, how has your own spiritual journey been one of both interiority and exteriority? Again, just uplifting the reality that in the West, we often have such a focus on the interior life. You know, it's all about coming to peace with your interior life. And it's harder for us to focus on the outworking of that love in the world. So for you, how are you holding those two things together? And this is sort of a central question of this series on the prophetic voice and prophetic action is, where's that kind of through line for you? So we're going to have about 20 minutes or so, 25 minutes to spend some time together in these reflection groups. As always,
Tim, can I interrupt for a minute?
Sure.
I know you were reticent to play the blessing for yourself, but I think we need to bless you right now. So before you go to send us to breakout rooms, could we do the blessing?
We can try. It's just going to take me a sec to pull it up because I didn't have it pulled up. One moment here.
We want your health to hold up.
Yeah, me too, Judith. Me too.
Well, I didn't realize it was going to be a...
No, it's okay. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to remove the spotlight here.
All right, this is for Tim.
We bless you as you share your gifts of spirit, light, and insight. We welcome you with joy.
Bless you.
Thank you all. All right. Okay, well, as I mentioned, we're going to get to carry these questions in the breakout group, or reflection group, sorry, for about 20, 25 minutes or so. We'll come back at 11:10 for a little bit more conversation.
She's here.
Maytag is here. And yeah, I look forward to hearing your reflections from this morning. So again, if you find yourself in a small group, I'll move you pretty quickly to a new one so that you can have at least three folks in your group. All right, here we go. All right. Well, it seems like everybody is back. So I'm curious to hear from you this morning. If you have something to share, questions, comments you'd like to offer up, you can raise your hand and we'll try to see it, or digitally raise your hand. And we can have a little conversation to finish our morning. Peggy, I see your hand. Just unmute and go ahead.
Good morning. In our group, we started to discuss some of the things that Dorothy Sola, I don't think I'm saying her name right, but
no, that's anyway, good.
That you brought up. And one question, and something I jotted down, but is quite kind of startling to me. And we wondered what your take on her quote was or is, and that is, God suffers and is powerless alongside us.
Mm.
Do you have your own kind of analysis of that?
I do. I'm somebody who is a process thinker, so process theology and philosophy. One thing that Alfred North Whitehead, who's the progenitor of that school of thought, says is that God is the fellow sufferer who understands. And part of that world, that theological worldview, is deconstructing notions of power that we've gotten or that we've inherited from imperialism. So I think early on, even in the Judeo-Christian tradition, our concept of God was Hellenized by sort of Greco-Roman philosophy. And the more poetic, metaphorical expressions of God we see in something like the Jewish Testament, you know, God is eagle's wings, God is nursing mother, God is a rock, get covered over by these notions of God as what got translated in the Septuagint as the Cosmacrator, the Almighty Creator. So when you, in the Western Christian tradition, get these prayers of Almighty God, yada, 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 right? Mm-hmm. That is actually a holdover from concepts of power that Caesar thought himself to have, all powerful. And so we have to ask ourselves, you know, the question of our tradition, our lineage, but also philosophically, metaphysically, do we live in a kind of universe where we see a God who's all powerful and can kind of do anything God wants at any moment? Or are there other concepts of power that are more about, a friend of mine, actually, Thomas J. Ord, who's a great theologian, said, has a book that just came out called The Death of Omnipotence and the Birth of Omnipotence, meaning the potency of love. And so I do think it's important for us to consider in our understanding of God where our understanding of power lies. Is it with coercion, domination, all powerful concepts of God like the Greek and Roman pantheons? Or is it most imaged in Jesus of Nazareth, who is a suffering one crucified on a cross and who was literally a fellow sufferer who understands the suffering of humanity? And then we kind of move from that place of theologizing, I guess. So that's my initial thought on that. If anyone has follow-up, we're welcome to dialogue about it.
Thank you. Very, very thought. Your thoughts are very thought-provoking too. Interesting.
Thanks. Yeah, Jackie, go ahead. Why don't you unmute?
I do have a follow-up on that. I feel as though God's power is the power that we give him. If we allow God to work in our lives, then that power will come through, but it has to come from us as well. So lots of things we pray for and we wonder why God isn't doing anything about it. He is blocked completely in many ways from being able to use his power. He's given it to us to give back to him.
Yeah. Mm. I hear that. It sounds like a meaningful articulation of your own experience in your spirituality. I love that. I think for me, one of the ways we talk about God in the process tradition is as a lure. So the way that God actually moves and works is as, you know, just like you would cast a fishing lure into the water to draw a fish toward it. God's love, God's call is sort of like a draw in our lives. And I think you're right. You know, like James Finley says, we have to take the inner stance of least resistance to be overtaken by that love in order for us to be cooperative with God and allow God to work. And so for me, that's one thing I talk about, which is a different concept of power or God's activity altogether than, say, a billiard cue hitting a billiard ball and making it go, right? Those are different concepts of power. A lure, a magnetizing force versus a what we would call a productive or a destructive force, something that bangs into other things and moves them around. So for me, that's one of the ways that we talk about that openness that you brought up, Jackie.
Or perhaps a door that's open for us, but we're the ones that have to step through it.
Perhaps. Yeah. Maura.
Hey, Tim. Great to see you.
Good to see you.
I just am struck by that word hyper-individualism. You know, where we swim in that water. And then I'm thinking about your organization, Way Collective, which feels like the very opposite of hyper-individualism. And I'm just curious how these ideas that you shared today are, you've seen embodied in your Way Collective, is a question. And then any advice for us to ponder how we move out of our hyper-individualism? And maybe that's part of the first question.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. It's a great observation. I would say that we've been trying to build a community around a shared vision. And so for us, again, in a non-coercive form of communal power versus hyper-individualized power that's located in something like the authoritarian figure in the community or something like that, right? We're trying to do something more collectivist in mind. So I think that's been built in from the ground up in our DNA to be a community who is agreeing to be community around shared practices and values, who is always gardening, tilling the soil of trying to grow rather than guarding boundary lines of belief, right? So this gardening versus gardening or guarding thing is a thing for me where hopefully our community is realizing that a committed way of life together that sort of transcends the hyper-individualized invitations in our society really is one that calls one another to mutuality in ways that are transformative because none of us have this figured out and we're working toward that together. Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those you make the road by walking kind of things where we're not perfect at this. We're definitely not perfect at the prophetic aspect of this, you know, but we're learning together and walking together and staying committed to try to decentralize power. And so we even have something called the sociocratic model of governance. If any of you have been on a church board where they use Robert's rules, right? And the majority of the church can vote a certain way and take it a certain way. I had to rewrite 28 pages of bylaws and constitutions around sociocracy, which is a fully communal consent-based model of decision-making where 100% of the community has to consent to the decision being made, not just a faction of it. So anyways, things like that are on the inner working side of it. But yeah, we're working to, yeah, sort of counteract some of those tendencies, I guess, as a community.
Yeah, thank you. It's nice to know it's possible. Thanks a lot.
Sure. I mean, again, we're learning as we go. Mm-hmm. Saw in the chat, Michael Dean asked me to repeat the quote from the Talmud, which says this, "Do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. Do justly now, love mercy now, walk humbly now. You are not obligated to complete the work, but neither are you free to abandon it." So that was the quote, Michael. And I see Gail sent me a message as well, asking me to clarify the comment that I made from the wheel that I showed, the wheel of compassion-based activism, around what it means to have firm limits around violation. And so essentially, I think what nonviolent resistance calls us to is to understand, like I mentioned Frank's quote, that violence is an affront to the moral fabric of our society. It does not belong here, you know? And so what I mean by that is nonviolent resistance isn't passivist with an IV, right? Or sorry, with an IV saying like, we're not going to even resist violent force at all. It resists violence with a pacifism, a CIF, I am, right? where like we can have firm limits to say that violation is not welcome here, violence is not welcome here. And I think that demands certain actions in different scenarios, but essentially it comes from, you know, just this heart to say that even as we uphold the dignity of oppressors, we still have to kind of get in the way and make good trouble, keeping folks from abuse, from oppression, from violation. And so the firm limit is a hard no to that. I don't know if that's clarifying for you, Gail, but if you want to talk more about that, we can.
It's helpful, Tim. We talked a lot in our group about loving our adversaries and being so depressed and saddened by violence that we see, but loving them. And then where is the firm limit?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, I think, you know, boundaries is a big thing right now in interpersonal relationships. And so think of this in a one-on-one setting. If you have somebody in your life who's been historically has had a pattern of abuse, right? Or, you know, verbal, physical, or otherwise kind of abuse in your relationship, one of those firm limits is getting in touch with yourself to say, do I need to set a boundary with this person? Yes. And does that look like articulating the boundary and having them agree not to step over it again? Yes. Does that sometimes look like estrangement? Yes. But it's up again, it's sort of particular to the situation, I think, where mm-hmm. you have to set firm limits with people that are sometimes we're close with, sometimes we're intimate with, sometimes it's very difficult, but it's important because it's a saying yes to that inherent beauty and dignity that we talked about too, at the same time that's within you that does not deserve to ever be overreached. You know what I mean? And so again, I think this happens on interpersonal levels with the one-on-one relationships, but it also happens, I think societally, we should set firm limits around violence and violation, right? Around, and we do that with some of our legislation, but we could also do that in better ways to keep certain forces in line that continue to oppress us. So boundary setting is really, I think, a part of the sort of maturation process too of an adult. Some of us have family of origin boundaries, right? We like go back into that setting. We're like, whoa, we got to be careful about what topics come up, what, you know, and what we're going to do. Yeah. And if those ever encroach on violation, we have to set firm.
Tim, I've had a request in the chat for you to send us that quote so I can send it out to people. And then would you send the wheel so I can send that out to people too?
Sure. Yeah, I can do that.
Thank you.
Yeah, Marie, go ahead and unmute. Make sure you unmute.
This is just getting back to your saying, you're talking about the Hellenistic view of God and the Hebrew view of God. And I think if we had more emphasis on God as mother, God as female, I don't know, our Western church is just so full of male images and male pronouns of God that we forget that yes. God is without gender. And that means we can also think about a nurturing God, not just an all-powerful God. So anyway, I just wish we could have a movement in that direction.
Well, there is a divine feminine reclamation happening right now, you know, which is really beautiful. I think, so just to, you know, make this very practical for some of you, like the Hebrew name of God, El Shaddai, which comes from the mountains, but it means the mountains being an image of breasts, the well-breasted one of Israel who nourishes Israel is a feminine image of God, El Shaddai. Some of you heard that Amy Grant song from the 80s, right? Maybe in church. Mm-hmm. But when the male patriarch formalized Christianity as a national religion and retranslated the Jewish Testament into the Septuagint, they covered over the nuance of El Shaddai and translated it, like I said earlier, Cosmacrator, which is like almighty creator of the cosmos. So they literally did away with the feminine images so that the image of God could look more like Caesar, right? Which is a male thing. And so we're, you know, there's been a reclamation happening where we're recovering those divine feminine images. I mean, you can't overlook Jesus saying that he wants to treat Israel like a mother hen. And those are, you know, words out of his own mouth, right? You know, and so if Jesus is comfortable using it, I think Christians should get down with it.
Thank you, Tim.
Yeah. I do have to head out to the doctor, actually, like right when we're done. So we have time for one more and then Judith can close us out if anybody has anything else. Or Michael will close out, that is. Yeah, Pat, you want to unmute and go ahead?
Thank you, Tim, for an enlightening and exciting morning. There are so many things that we're all walking home with that you're going to keep us busy with for the next, not just this series, but I think maybe for the rest of our lives. But I'm wondering, Tim, what has happened to the Claremont School of Theology? Where is it now?
It is moving around. So right now, some of you might have known that it went up to Willamette, Oregon for a bit for a partnership. That partnership has since dissolved, and they're actually back in Claremont for the moment. But a lot of their courses are online, and they're still in the process of settling with the Claremont schools there with the property so that they can figure out where their next move will be. But they're in process, as good process Claremontians will affirm, you know.
Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Well, Tim, we want to be respectful of your time. So thank you for a rich and thought-provoking presentation today. We will gather again around our Zoom table next Thursday, October 12th. We'll be looking at chapters 9 and 10. Patience, that'll be interesting to talk about, won't it? Patience and failure. Our speaker will be Rebecca Parker, who is the executive director of Mary's and Martha's Place in Atlanta, a center for women's spiritual formation and transformation. And we hope to see all of you back then. So please feel free to unmute, thank Tim, and say goodbye to your fellow Word and Lifers.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, y'all.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
See you next week.
Good to be together.
Nice to see everybody.
We'll see you soon.
Next Thursday. Thanks. Thank you.
Bye. We'll see you soon.